You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Brian Bellow. If you're new to the podcast, each week, along with my colleagues, Joanne Freeman, Nathan Connolly, and Ed Ayers, we explore a different aspect of American history. In my time at Backstory, I've discussed a whole range of different topics with a lot of different people. I've talked to academic historians, sometimes even politicians. But the conversations that stand out most in my mind are the ones I've had with everyday people. People who have lived, made, and engaged with history, sometimes in surprising ways. These are the people that are coming to grips with the product of history on a day-to-day basis. And of course, these are the people who are quite literally making history as we podcast. So on today's episode, I'm excited to share some of my favorite Backstory moments with you. This is part of an ongoing series we're doing as Backstory wraps up after more than 12 years. You'll learn about the American twist on a traditional Mexican dish, and you'll revisit a trip I took to the Blue Ridge Mountains to find out what life is like behind the walls of a Catholic convent. But first up, I wanted to share a conversation I had back in 2005 with members of a prison work crew on the side of a road in Virginia. Over the years, scholars have spent a lot of time talking about something they call the carceral state. It's a term that refers to the criminal justice system, the power it gives to police officers, lawyers, and judges, and how it disproportionately affects marginalized peoples. I wanted to know what it's like to live in the grips of the carceral state and to work on the side of a busy road on display to passing motorists in orange jumpsuits. I talked to our producers at Backstory because I had seen these people at work. And I said, you know, we're doing a show on the history of prisons. I want to talk to those folks on the side of the road. So here's my conversation from Land of the Free, the history of incarceration in the U.S.
My name is Corporal Horace Bruce from Alma Shawford Regional Jail. I'm the supervisor for the road gang. Today we is on Avon Street cleaning up.
My first question for you is this a punishment or is this a reward? I mean, a drive-by, I think punishment, but then it occurs to me this might be better than sitting in jail.
It is. The guys enjoy coming out. I mean, they love the weather, they love the scenery. This is actually a gift.
So what have these guys done to earn this gift?
Well, depending on the years that they got, if they were sentenced for 3 years or less, they can actually come on board. A lot of guys can't come on due to the fact they got over 3 years and their crimes. Cocaine stuff, they can't come out. Assault charges, they can't come out. These guys right here is mainly child supports, DUI type guys, so they can actually come out and work.
We are a history show, and certainly over the course of history, one form of punishment for people who have committed crimes has been kind of public humiliation, public
shame. So putting people in stocks, and we've heard about the scarlet letter for adulterers. Is there anything about making these guys wear orange and having them along this pretty well-traveled street here that entails humiliation? Are they embarrassed?
No. Actually, the orange is an indication of the best inmates that we have in the building. The worst inmates, I say worst, the guys that can come out, they were black and white. These guys right here wear oranges, meaning that they are trustees and they can be trusted. I tell you, I'll go get one.
All right. I really appreciate you talking to us today. I want to get a view from your perspective of what this is all about. At least Corporal Bruce says that this is a privilege to be able to come out here, get a little fresh air. Now, he's carrying that big stick and has a gun, so I understand you have to think carefully about how you answer this question. But what is it like for you to, is this a punishment or is this a reward for you?
Mentally being away from my family, just being incarcerated, period,
sure,
that is punishment, you know what I'm saying? But as far as being out here, nah, man, it's a privilege, man. I love it. I get to come out here and get fresh air, you know what I'm saying, sunlight. A lot of people don't have that privilege, you know. They're confined to a small space all day, and I look at a whole bunch of other people that just like them. I mean, I don't know.
We're standing out here by a road. People are driving by. How do you feel about the public aspect of this? Are you ashamed, or do you see people you know sometimes? Anyone ever ask someone to get you a cheeseburger on the way, or you know, how does that work?
Sometimes, see, I'm from Alamar County, so sometimes depending on the area we're in, I do feel a little ashamed, but I mean, this program takes very good care of me, you know what I'm saying? I get paid for what I do. So I don't have to call home, ask for money or anything like that. So basically I said, they're going to work, so am I.
Can I ask you how much you get paid for this?
We get paid $3 a day, $15 a week.
Uh-huh. Can I ask you how long you've been in prison?
I've been locked up going on 22 months.
And may I ask you when you think you're going to get out?
I'll get out December 19th, God willing.
May I ask you, and you don't have to answer this, what you're in for?
I'm here for a violation and driving on revoked license.
I see. Seems like a lot of time for revoked license.
Yeah, well, after they see you for a couple of times, you know, more than twice, then they tend to lay the hammer down on you. So.
Yeah. Do you think all this time you've spent in prison is going to have any effect at all?
I tell you what, the last few times I came to jail, I didn't want to change my behavior. After this time, I can't do it no more.
What's different?
Age.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten older. I've matured. I'm 30 years old.
30 years old.
Yep. In my adolescent days, I didn't really care. You know, I rip around the streets, didn't really care much. But now I have kids. I got 3 children, so they need a father figure, you know what I'm saying? And I got to be a role model. I don't want my sons to go through what I've had to go through.
Could I ask you how often you get to see your kids?
I don't see them.
You don't see them?
No, I don't.
Is that the toughest thing about being in prison?
Yeah.
I can imagine. Well, I really appreciate you talking to me today, and
okay.
I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Now we're going to take a look at what life is like within the confines of another very different institution, a Catholic convent. It was all part of a broader exploration of Catholicism in America, and in particular, how the experiences of Catholics have changed from the 18th and 19th centuries to today. Not being Catholic myself, I knew very little about the religious practices of nuns, and even less about how they live on a day-to-day basis. So this turned out to be an absolutely fascinating glimpse at the way nuns combine their religion and their day-to-day lives almost seamlessly. So here's my conversation from the show Catholics in America. As it turns out, there's a Trappist monastery down the road from our studios in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's one of just 17 across the country. So I took a trip out there with our producer, Emily Gaddick.
All right, here we go.
Our Lady of the Angels sits at the end of a dirt road. It's on the edge of the forest in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The building, it's nothing fancy. It looks like the kind of two-story brick church you might see in a new suburb.
Hello.
Hi.
13 sisters live in the monastery. We spoke to four of them. Sister Barbara, who helped found the convent in the late 1980s. Sister Sophie, who came from India. Sister Maria, originally from Spain. And Sister Kathy, who joined the community after serving in the United States Air Force for 15 years.
I'm entering my 15th year in the monastery, so I've now been in the monastery as long as I was on active duty. And
I know you don't say mazel tov, but congratulations. Is that in order?
Thank you. Yes.
It's no surprise that the sisters' lives were nothing like the horrors Rebecca Reed detailed in the 1830s. Much of their daily life in that monastery revolves around prayer. Sister Barbara told us that their day begins at 3 a.m. That's when the sisters rise for their first of many rounds of prayer throughout the day. But the nuns also work. For Our Lady of the Angels, that means making sinfully good Gouda cheese. People come from miles around to buy it. Here's Sister Maria describing the process.
I'm what we call the cheese cook, the one who does part of the process of making the cheese, turning the milk into cheese. Mm-hmm. So besides putting the culture and all the things you have to put in there so that you get cheese at the end, most of the time we work in silence. So when we are working, we are praying with our whole body. So I do put a lot of prayers for the people who are going to have the cheese, for so many people who ask us for prayers, who tell us about their troubles in their families.
And just like any homeowners, Sister Kathy says they have to put a lot of work into simply maintaining the place.
So a lot of my time during the day is either doing plumbing, calling a plumber. And that's where YouTube comes in handy, because there isn't anything you can't need to fix that you can't find somebody doing it on YouTube.
I have to admit, these nuns surprised me. They laughed at my jokes, unlike most people. They watched YouTube, and they had strong opinions about current issues like climate change. Sisters Kathy and Maria say they even surprised themselves by entering the convent.
I never thought about becoming a nun. I didn't like nuns too much.
Why do you say that?
Well, you know, I mean, we all have our own ideas of what people do. And I mean, I wasn't the kind of person I thought that was going to be a nun.
I kind of had the same experience that Maria had. It was kind of an oh no kind of experience. I never thought of cloistered life as being for me. I've always been, you know, pretty active and enjoyed being in the world. But there were some clear messages that came. It just grew more and more in my heart that really the significance and importance of prayer in my life.
I love writing history. But I will confess, if I could use that word, that there are days and sometimes even months where I have real doubts about my chosen life as an historian. None of you expressed any doubt about your faith itself. You've expressed doubt perhaps about being in the right place. Have you experienced those moments?
Sure, I think that's part of the Christian life. And doubt is the flip side of faith. It's eventually what makes our faith even stronger. And I remember saying to our superior that I finally reached a point where I was pretty certain that I was, what's the word for people who don't believe in God?
Atheist. Agnostic or atheist.
Atheist, okay. I can't believe I can't remember these words. But I told her, I said, well, I think I'm atheist. I don't think I believe in God anymore. And her simple response was, well, that's nice. That's, you know, it will pass. That's fine. And she's right. It does pass.
Two of you mentioned that when you realized that you were being called, your response was, uh-oh. And given that that's a pretty typical reaction, or to put it another way, that this is an unusual form of life in this very modern society we live in, do you ever worry about the future? Do you worry about the continuation of this way of life?
As far as worry, not worry. I think the monastic life will last as long as the humankind lives, because it speaks to something deep in the human heart. Maria was saying a few moments ago, this desire to give oneself totally to God and to receive as much of God as God will give in this life, to put it one way. But individual monasteries won't last forever. No human institution does, you know. And that doesn't matter. So concern, but not worry. And the best contribution we can make to that is just living the life as fully with as much of our love as we can.
Thanks to sisters Barbara, Sophie, Maria, and Kathy from Our Lady of the Angels, a Trappist monastery in Crozet, Virginia. You can find more information about the sisters, including how to purchase their cheese, on their website, olamonastery.org. If you're not hungry from all that talk of cheese, or you just want more cheesy jokes, don't worry. We've got just a little bit more for you. I wanted to end this edition of The Best of Backstory with an interview I did with Patty Hinich, host of the PBS show Patty's Mexican Kitchen. Back in 2017, I visited Patty at her home outside of Washington, D.C. We talked about all things cooking, in particular, the roots of a Mexican staple turned American classic, the burrito. And I'm not talking about mules.
Hola.
Hey, Brian.
Soy Brian.
How are you?
¿Cómo estás?
Nice to meet you.
Ramona.
Hola, Ramona.
Of course, beautiful house.
Pleasure. Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a little bit not Mexican outside, but once you come in, it feels very
She takes us into her kitchen and picks up something that looks kind of like a bell pepper.
So this is a poblano chili, and it's my favorite chili. Because it's adorable. Just look at it. It's like super curvy. It's chubby. It's shiny.
You play favorites with your chili?
This is my favorite, really, of them. Well, no. The chipotle, too. Now I don't know. I mean, I love the poblanos. And so this is fresh. And then...
Hinich is passionate about Mexican food. She grew up in Mexico City, and she's lived in the U.S. for 20 years now. So I was anxious to hear her thoughts on Mexican food in the U.S., especially the American burrito.
I don't know who decided to add everything into the burrito, which was, you know, the meat, the seasoned meat or chicken or whatever protein. And then, oh, if you're going to eat the rice and the beans, why don't we throw it in there too? So it's the rice and the beans and the guacamole. And then these other American garnishes are added, you know, the sour cream and the cheddar cheese and more salsa. And I think that Americans absolutely love the burritos, and Mexicans look at the American burritos and think, oh my God, what did they do to this dish, you know? So I want to show you the Mexican way.
So you might have found something like the burrito in the 16th century, when Spanish conquistadors introduced wheat flour to the native diet.
So in the south of Mexico, everybody was making corn tortillas, and there was no way to you know, add flour tortillas to that repertoire, because the south of Mexico adores its corn tortillas. But from the center to the north, they started adapting the tortilla to the flour tortilla, which was also sort of a variation of the pan árabe, or pita bread, that the Spanish had brought with them.
It turns out the American burrito is a direct descendant of the Mexican burrita.
Always made with a flour tortilla that is fresh, you know, either just made or from the tortilleria. And it's always heated. It's never served cold or as a wrap. And it only has one ingredient, but the ingredient is one exquisite ingredient. You know, it's not a piece of meat that you throw in there. It's chilorio, for example, which is what I made for you, which is Pork butt or shoulder, you have to use meat that still has fat in it. And it has orange juice and water. And so the meat first cooks in that until it's completely cooked and it starts caramelizing. And then you shred that meat and you finish it off in an ancho chile sauce or adobo. And the ancho chile sauce or adobo has ancho chilies. You have to remove the stem. And then after you remove the stem, you open it up. And then you let all of the seeds out. White onion, garlic cloves, parsley, oregano, a judicious amount of cumin, black pepper, and vinegar. I like to add a splash of apple cider vinegar. And then you just let that cook until the liquid has become very thick and the meat has really absorbed it. And then you have this.
Patty rolled the chilorio in a flour tortilla, and when I finally got to taste it...
Mmm, that's amazing.
What does it taste like?
It tastes succulent and spicy, and the flavors just keep exploding.
Right.
They're really absolutely amazing.
So, some people will also... add some avocado slices on the side or guacamole. But the thing is, when you don't pack everything together, you can really shine a light on the taste of the chilorio in a well-made flour tortilla. When you throw everything in there, it's, you know, you can't appreciate, I think.
Sounds almost like a philosophy for life.
Right, right.
Patty, I must tell you, this is really the most amazing food.
And this is really low-key Mexican food. I mean, this is nothing sophisticated. This is really, you know, burritos or burritas made with chilorio or machaca are really workers, you know, construction site
right.
workers.
The guys doing your street.
Yeah, but there's this pride, you know, for all Mexicans that... no matter who you are, where you come from, food is fabulous, you know?
There was one final step in my burrito investigation. We brought a pork burrito from a popular national chain, which I will not name, for a taste test. You know, for scientific rigor.
I'm game.
Okay, let's open this up. I'll give you instructions, too. First you open the bag.
Right.
Right, then you, many would throw the bag out their car window. No, I'm just kidding. We would never do that. So already you can see the difference. This is gigantic,
right.
Gargantuan, you might say, even after we cut it in half.
The tortilla is probably the size of like a pizza, right?
This is the burrito that ate Chicago, apparently.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Okay.
You can see, and mind you, whoever assembled this didn't begin to put all the possibilities in, yet there are what? At least 5, 6, 7 different ingredients.
I want to taste the meat that went in here.
Okay.
Okay, let me see.
You know, this is the first time I've seen you stop smiling since we walked into the house.
I don't love it. This, I think, is like if you're starving and they give this to you, you eat it and you're thankful, you know? But I don't think this is something that you stop and sit down for.
Right. Entirely forgettable.
Right. But I'm very grateful that you brought it.
Patty Hinnich hosts the award-winning PBS show, Patty's Mexican Table.
You can find a recipe for Chogorio Burritas on our website at backstoryradio.org.
That's going to do it for us today. Thanks for joining me in this look back to some of my favorite moments from Backstory. I'd love to know your thoughts about these segments or what some of your favorite Backstory moments have been. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.